OTB Gold, the very best of off the ball.
Are you crazy?
This is OTB Sports Radio.
Are you a complete rookie? What are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? Are you crazy?
Absolutely brilliant manoeuvre by Mansell. Fantastically brilliant.
It's been a hell of a life and a career, yeah. Thank you for giving me this platform to announce my retirement.
Wexford lead 2:13 to 2:8.
The treatment was tough. You were given every encouragement and every chance to survive.
When I was 13, 14, I was playing on about 13 to 14 teams at the time.
OTB Gold, the very best of off the ball. Weekdays from 1 p.m. and 6 p.m.
OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
All right, you're welcome along. It is Friday Night Racing and Off the Ball, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie or follow the new Twitter account at HRI Racing and use the hashtag Every Racing Moment. As always, we're joined by Johnny Ward. Afternoon, Johnny.
How are you getting on, Nathan?
Not too bad. And our guest today is thoroughbred breeder Joe Foley. He runs Ballyhane Stud and Leyland Bridge in Carlow with his wife Jane, where they stand four stallions, Dandy Man, Soldier's Call, Elzam and Prince of Lear. And this day last week was a very big day for Joe, because at Royal Ascot, two of his stallions' progeny won at Royal Ascot. Joe, great to talk to you.
Yeah, good afternoon, Nathan. Thanks very much. Good afternoon, Johnny.
Last Friday was one of the good days.
I'd say, Nathan, last Friday was one of the best days. It was a brilliant day, magical stuff. You don't dare to dream that something like that can happen. And when the first filly won, Dandala, half an hour later, the Learjet won the Norfolk Stakes. It was sort of like winning the All-Ireland football final and then going out and winning the All-Ireland hurling final half an hour later. And I'm from Carlow. We don't do that too often down there.
Yeah, it's a fantastic story, as you say. Dandala won the Albany Stakes, and then the very next race, the Learjet won the Norfolk Stakes. What were your emotions like over that half hour, 45-minute period?
Oh, difficult to sum it up. I'd say frenzied. Well, I was thrilled, delighted that the first filly won, Dandala. Couldn't dare to dream that the second colt had won, and I'd sold him as a yearling myself. But I couldn't believe it. It was disbelief. Incredible stuff.
We talked to jockeys, to trainers, to owners, to all sorts of people who are involved, and talk about that, what it means when you win these big races. Breeders, it often feels, are the forgotten part of it at times. That I know straight away they go down through the lineage of the horse that wins these big flat races, but it's seen as more the business side of things. But there is obviously that other side as well, that just sheer emotion, that sport side that you love to be a part of.
As a breeder, you get as big a buzz of winning or breeding the winner of a big race like that as the owner would get, or the jockey or the trainer. It means a lot to you, and financially it means a lot, because you have the stallion or the sire of the winner, as I have, or the dam of it, or a half brother or a half sister, and you'll get an upturn in the marketplace for its siblings, for example. So it means a lot, both emotionally and financially.
It was Prince of Lear as well. What have you made of his start, Joe? Because obviously I think that was his first winner. It's just to get a flagship. I think he won the race himself as well back in the day. So how has he been sort of received, and how important is that to put him on the map?
He'd been received sort of pretty okay before that. Nothing major. I mean, I sold that colt. I bought him as a foal for €9,500 and sold him for £8,000. So you can do the maths yourself. It wasn't a spectacular financial transaction. So to have that colt turn up and remain unbeaten and win the Norfolk Stakes and ask it, as you say, Johnny, like his father did, Prince of Lear, before him. That was magic. And, already you can see an upturn in the stallion's progeny. He had the top two price lots at a breeze up sale yesterday. And, that's big time for us here.
And in terms of how do you land on a stallion, what attracted you to him in the first place? Obviously, he's by Kodiak with a really good Royal Ascot as well. But what attracts you to a stallion? And then is it a question of whether you can actually afford bringing that stallion to Ballyhane?
Yeah, it's all of that. It's a balance of things, Johnny and Nathan. It's what you can afford. Number one, I saw that horse first at a breeze up sale, which is where horses sort of run for 2 furlongs in a sort of a barrier trial, and it's attached to a sale. And he was the fastest horse on the show that day, and he topped the sale. He was the highest priced horse that day. He then won his first two starts, including the Norfolk Stakes at Royal Ascot. He lost his way somewhat after that and got a little bit injured. And I sort of latched onto him and thought he'd make a nice stallion prospect. Nice pedigree by Kodiak, as you say, out of good mare. I went to see him in Robert Cowell's yard in Newmarket and loved him as an individual. And I decided to invest some of my hard-earned cash in him.
And he's paid you back, I think it's fair to say. Talk to us a bit more about Prince of Lear then. So Prince of Lear is a first-season sire. And in fact, this is the first season, actually, his progeny have been on the race course. So to have a winner in the Norfolk in the first season, and I know Prince of Lear won it as well, but like that's pretty remarkable and pretty promising sign.
It is, yeah. Everybody's watching the progeny of first season stars, you know, stallions with their first runners hit the track just to see what they're like. And they can be quite quick to form an impression, both favourable and unfavourable. So if your first 15 runners turn up at the racetrack and there's no good one there, people can you know, quite easily go off them in the marketplace. So to actually do the opposite and throw up a horse like the Learjet from his first number of runners, is a big deal. Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's in terms of, you mentioned the kind of the fashion of it there. We'd say Kodiak, I think he started off as a 5 grand stallion. He's now 65, and I remember comparing him to Dylan Thomas one time when Kodiak was standing for 50 grand having started at 5, and Dylan Thomas was standing for 5 grand having started at 50. So the Galileo would say in his early days he actually went down in price because he's obviously his first crop or two weren't necessarily setting the world on fire. But with a horse like him, obviously you'd expect him to be sharper. So the first season must be absolutely massive, because is it a case in racing that people start talking and a bit of a group thing takes place where they more or less agree that this stallion isn't much good and they move on to something else? And maybe there's a, you know, there's an aspect in for sort of for more maybe astute and patient breeders to say, well, hang on a sec, like we actually might have to give this horse a bit more time and see how he gets on. So like it does seem to be really, really based on fashion, how they're perceived.
It is. You're right, Johnny. But you know something, I always say, normally they're right. The sort of fashion police are normally right. They don't get it wrong too often. When they go off a sire, if they watch his first runners, for example, and there's no good horse in there, they can go off him in the marketplace and can go off him fashion-wise. But you know what? Normally they're right. However, you've got to keep a watching brief. You see some stallions and they can improve and they can also disimprove. So it's a movable feast. You need to keep your eyes open and keep watching the racetracks, the results from the racetrack, and keep watching everything. And a stallion can do badly one year because he had sort of bad mares that went to him or whatever, and likewise he can do very well the following year if better mares had gone to him in that season. So it, as I said, it's a movable feast.
What do you look for in a stallion, Joe?
Oh, it's a huge amount of things, but pedigree, race record first. You try and buy as good a racehorse as you can. Pedigree second. Physicality, you know, confirmation, good looking horse, an attractive horse at number one. People, you know, if he gets progeny in his own like, people will like them at the sale. Temperament is a thing I put a lot of emphasis on. It doesn't matter if you've all the rest, if they're bad tempers, they often pass that on to their progeny, and that's not good. Kodiak, a horse you mentioned there, is a great example. On the race, you know, that's what you love to do. The best racehorse, the best pedigree, the best looking horse you can get or you can afford. However, sometimes you've got to relax on one of them, Kodiak being the perfect example.
He didn't even win a group race, did he?
No, he didn't. But, you know, he had a lot of ability. I'd say he had a little problem in training that just didn't allow him to show his full potential on the track. But he had a magnificent pedigree. He was by a brilliant sire and out of a brilliant mare. A brother to Invincible Spirit, who's proved a brilliant sire in the Irish National Stud for everybody. And while he didn't do it on the racetrack, he definitely had the ability, and when he went to stud, that ability came out, and the pedigree came out in all his progeny. He's been a wonderful stallion for the O'Callaghan family in Mullingar.
If you had the choice of an exceptionally well-bred horse who was a little bit disappointing at the track but went to stud, or a badly bred horse who was an exceptional racehorse, what would you go for?
Both. Sorry. It's a difficult one, Johnny.
You see, I suppose, time and time again, these top performers at the track that didn't have much of a pedigree are more or less found out at stud that they just don't have it.
Correct, yeah. I think nearly pedigree would supersede everything else. If they didn't really do it on the track, if they did it, if they didn't do it on the track for maybe a temperament reason, I wouldn't be interested. But if, you know, if they had a little injury or something like that that didn't allow them to fulfill their full potential, and they had the big pedigree, I'd go for him, definitely.
When you're talking about temperament and the stock that you put in temperament, what are you talking about there?
The will to win. Right. Essentially, like any good sports person or any good athlete, it's the will to win. It's the ability to dig in the last 100 meters of a 5K race on the track and field. You know, it's that pure willingness to win. I mean, see some horses racing, their heads can go up and furlong out. They look like they've all the ability in the world. They trade long odds on and running in races, and they just don't go ahead and deliver and win the race. Whereas a horse that looks beaten can put his head down and gallop to the line and beat everything else. Hurricane Fly being a perfect example. You know, it's the attitude, really, the will to win.
I guess in some ways that's what separates one breeder from another, then, because everybody can see the pedigree of a horse, or everybody can see the results of a race. The temperament is the side that it's basically up to yourself, you making that decision. That process, is that something you feel you've got better at over the years of judging a horse's temperament?
Well, I suppose I've taken it into account when I'm buying a stallion. That's one thing I do more than I did maybe, you know, years ago. I remember buying a stallion once, and he had everything on paper. He was a good racer. So he had a lovely pedigree. But he was sort of a mean-spirited character. And, you know, he passed that on to his progeny, and it did not excel in the racetrack. So that one taught me a lesson.
Are you a one-man band when it comes to buying a stallion, or have you a team of people that you rely on so that you're not just making this big decision by yourself?
No, I sort of do it on my own, but I'd have a couple of people that I'd sort of just float a horse to and see what they thought of him. But listen, you have to do it yourself, I'm afraid. You have to be cojones.
Yeah. What's a ballpark figure if you were to buy a young stallion that you would might stand for, say, 4 or 5 grand or something like that? What would you expect to pay for him?
Oh, a 4 or 5 grand stallion. Well, he's going to cost $500,000 to $1 million, somewhere like that.
Right.
Wow.
And so how does your budget work then? Like, are you kind of happy to go over your budget if you're particularly keen, or are you quite determined that you'll kind of stay within budget?
Well, there's two ways of getting your money back. Number one, the sale of your progeny by that stallion that you breed yourself, obviously, and the sale of nomination fees to other breeders. So you just try and work out whether a horse is going to be popular to breeders and they're going to send mares to him, and, you know, you'll recoup some of your cash that way from nomination fees, and also hope that your clients do well in the sales ring and in the racetrack in the future, obviously. But also that, you know, that you sell the progeny by that sire yourself, and you'll recoup the money over the years. But sometimes you do, and believe me, sometimes you don't. It's a high-risk industry. That's why there's not too many people doing it.
As the layman on Friday Night Racing, I'm not sure what the etiquette is around talking money when it comes to the breeding game, but can we ask what the most you've paid for? Maybe it is public knowledge already. What's the most you paid for a stallion?
All stallion deals are private. You know, you don't buy them at public auctions.
Right.
So I think, but it's more than the figure I mentioned earlier.
Right.
You know, it's scary stuff. But to help you do that, sometimes you can spread the risk by syndicating a horse.
Okay.
So you divide them into shares, and you know that's a way of spreading risk, and obviously getting support for your stallion from other breeders. I think that's what most people try and do.
And in terms then of matching up mares with the stallions, after a day like last Friday, is your phone off the hook?
Yes, but unfortunately for us, the stud season is over this year, so we don't get an instant return this year in extra mares or extra nomination fees this year. But, you know, already interest for next year is better. And as I said 10 minutes ago, you know, there was a breeze up sale in Newmarket yesterday, and Prince of Lyra's progeny, they were the top price and the second top price of that sale. So those people that sold those made a large profit on those two. So they'll be back buying progeny by Prince of Lyra. And the same applies to Dandyman. A colt by him sold very, very well yesterday for Norman Williamson, the ex-jump jockey. So he'll be back buying them again. So we hopefully will get the spin-off into the future.
How has it kind of changed in terms of, you know, you see Coolmore, I suppose, increasingly trying to find the right match for their Galileo mares, and invariably now it seems to be that they do want to go for a lot of speed, and if you match speed with stamina, you might get a long-term future, and you just might get enough stamina to kind of go and win a derby or whatever, even if you have a sort of a speed side on the sire side. Like, from your perspective, how has the game changed in the last 20 years and 20, 25 years, or say, has it changed more towards emphasis on speed, or is the derby still sort of the holy grail in terms of what you're looking for in a stallion?
No, I think the derby has lost some of its appeal than it had maybe 20 or 30 years ago. I think, you know, you're talking about values and prize money. Prize money levels are still very similar to what they were 20 or 30 years ago. The cost of producing horses is more. The cost of training horses is more. The owner breeders of the old era have died away. So the owners tend to be a commercial people nowadays, and they want a quicker return on their money, given the expensive training fees that currently are there. So they tend to go for faster, more precocious horses nowadays than maybe was the case 20 and 30 years ago.
Would you want to, like, I guess if you have a sharp 2-year-old who isn't necessarily going to train on, like that's probably not something. Like, what's a breeder actually really looking for in turn? Like, he obviously wants a 2-year-old who's going to still be going strong at 3, but what's the boutique kind of horse that one is looking for at the moment? Is that like essentially a Guineas winner?
Correct, Johnny. That's exactly it. I think most people are looking for a good 2-year-old, you know, a horse that was a good group performer at 2 that trains on into a Guineas horse at 3 and a champion miler at 3. You know, Siskin, for example, Gerard Lyons horse that won the Guineas. He won the Phoenix Stakes last year in the Curragh, that Group 1 race over 6 furlongs, and now he's won the Irish Guineas over a mile, first time out at 3. I think that's the sort of horse people are looking for now, for breeding with anyway, in the industry, rather than the old-fashioned Derby winner.
How would you assess Siskin as well? Because I suppose, Nathan, this is the interesting thing, that when Siskin won the Guineas, obviously he became a very you know, very good stallion prospect, but he's not particularly well-bred. And the word had been that he'd been bought, his breeding rights had been bought, possibly associates of Coolmore, still possibly a little bit vague as to who actually bought him. But how would you assess his, like, you can imagine him now being matched with Galileo mares, and it could go completely either way, Joe.
Yeah, very much. He's by First Defence. He's interestingly bred, an American-bred horse, but he's from a deep Judmont family, and they're one of the best groups of breeders in the world, the Judmont team. So he's a well-bred horse. He's a very good-looking horse, and he's obviously a good horse, and Gerard Lyons and his team have done a great job with him. So he's a very interesting stallion prospect.
Not going to Ballyhane, though.
Not yet, anyway.
In terms of that then, and say taking Siskin for the example, you talk about matching Siskin up with a Galileo mare, how much of that can be based on science in advance in terms of, as you say, the bloodlines? Has the breeding game changed dramatically in terms of technology and science in recent years?
Yes, quite a bit. There's a lot more technical side to it. Whether it's accurate or not, nobody knows. I mean, the horse has to get into a stall and run on a grass field over a mile and see can he beat the other ones. You know, I don't know how you can attach full technology to that. There's loads of people assessing horses' gene pool and genetics. There's other people assessing their heart, their stride rate, obviously all the old pedigree theories that went in, the inbreeding, line breeding, dosage theories. I could bore you for hours on that one. But you know what? I don't think no one knows. It's not an exact time.
It sounds like you've had a lot of salesmen around trying to sell you any amount of technology, any amount of new inventions that are going to make you a lot of money, but you're still not fully convinced.
I remember when I should have been studying from a leaving cert many years ago, I studied the sort of pedigree theories around bloodstock and racing at the time, instead of studying for chemistry and biology. And I remember after 2 years of this intense study, I decided that nobody really knew.
Yeah,
so I haven't listened to anybody ever since. I just do my own thing.
I actually think it's, you know, when I was getting into racing, and Robert Hall used to be kind of going on about, oh, bred by such and such, and I was like, yawn, yawn, yawn. And then as I got older, I was like, geez, there's so much going on here, because, you know, when you see the breeding of a horse, and you're there maybe when that foal is born and track that progress. And I had a horse up in a field there in Leeds. It was Mary Davison's land, and she would have bred Ivywood. And Mary was like an unbelievably good breeder for the stock she had. But John Tuttle is a breeder who has horses beside the field next door, basically. And I got to know all these yearlings and got to know them kind of in terms of their characters and the way they walked in the field and what sort of playfulness or stride they had and all this. And next thing you know, a half brother to one of them wins his Newmarket maiden, and he's a short price to win a race of Royal Ascot. Another horse then goes on to do something else, and then it's a full brother to Persuasive, who's this unbelievably lovely Dark Angel horse that was in the field. And every time something from the family runs, you'd be texting John Tuttle, and he'd be saying, "Oh, this is great." And there's so much going on apart from people betting on racing. And I don't know, Joe, is it something that we don't really promote enough in terms of, like, aside from the betting side of racing, just so much going on in terms of getting familiar with horses, and they becoming, you know, as much as they're obviously costs, you know, you're trying to make money on them, they do become part of your life in terms of your family as well.
Yeah, sure. It's a complete way of life. Anytime I go racing and I might meet a non-racing mate afterwards and I tell him I was at the races and he'd say, "Well, did you make money?" I don't bet, never bet. I might have a fiver on something twice a year, but I might have made a lot of money at the races by having the half-brother or the half-sister or the dam or the star of one of the big winners or something like that. And I think most breeders are the same. You just go racing. There's a huge depth to racing that a lot of people don't see. And the depth is the industry that's beside it, which is what I do, the production of horses for it. And we here in Ireland are one of the best people in the world for producing race horses. We produce, I think, the second or third largest crop of thoroughbreds in the world. And I'd say we're it's one of the things we're really good at in this country.
Yeah, that depth is in the breeding industry as well. 6,000 registered breeders in Ireland, which I was very surprised by. And as you say, I think Ger Lyons was on last week saying over in Britain, they like to think that they're the leading racing nation in the world. And he had something to say about that, I think, to put it mildly. And you do look at the statistics. 10 of the 14 top-rated two-year-olds in Europe last year were bred in Ireland. And then over the jumps, 12 of the 14 Grade 1 winners at the Cheltenham Festival this year were bred or trained in Ireland. So when it comes to the stock of Irish racing, it's in a pretty good place right now.
Yeah, it is. And traditionally, it is. And Irish people are very good breeders. We have a great climate for it here. You know, all the rain that we complained about during the summer, we think it's a godsend because it's what allows us to breed good horses. That, you know, the land isn't too arid or too dry. Irish horse people are innate horsemen. And I think we're very, very good at it. It's one of the things we're really good at in this country. And maybe we'd like to think it doesn't get enough attention.
Don't get Johnny Ward started on the climate.
Yeah.
Well, from the west, it's always raining over there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's just, I suppose, before he goes, Nathan, it is good to sum up Joe. It's something of an anecdote. I think I met him first at Cheltenham Preview Night in Castlebar. Now, why Joe Foley was on a Cheltenham Preview panel is really, you could write a book on that and come up with some sort of a theory that may or may not be true. But he was travelling with Tony Mullins, and they had a driver, a designated driver, and they left us, I'd say it was about half one in the morning, to go back to more or less Loughlin Bridge direction, Goran direction in Carlow from Castlebar, which is a Mayo man, you can pretty much quickly conclude is quite a long journey. So I was up at the bar, and one of the guys who organised it said, "I can't believe they left. I had all this beautiful steak, organic steak that I was going to give them." I think his name was JP. I was going to give them as a gift to Tony and Joe or whatever for coming down. And this is about half an hour after they left. And I was like, "I don't know, you should just ring them just in case. They just might turn back. You never know. They are racing people. They know the value of money." "Sure." And he said, if they don't turn back, I'll give you the stake. I'll give you the whole lot." So I was like, happy days, but probably should just say it anyway. And sure enough, he rang half an hour down the road to Kilkenny at about 2 a.m. They turned back to get the stake.
That's a true story. I think I was asleep most of the way, so I didn't really notice. But I was told
Joe
later
wasn't
that
a designated driver.
No, that's true. I was told we turned around in Moat, which is I remember getting home about 5:30. That was Tony Mullins for you.
Moat.
Yeah.
That's so. If you're accusing me of embellishing the story, I actually didn't go far enough. So there you go.
Yeah. Was the steak worth it?
Oh, I didn't get any. Tony Mullins was involved. He took the stick.
Well, I brought it home. I did guess. Your man felt sorry for me, so he gave me like 6 vacuum-packed ribeyes, just organic stuff. And I remember my father saying to me, "That is literally the best steak I've ever had." And he was about 70-odd at the time. So they do breed something in Mayo. I don't know what it is, though, Nathan.
Yeah, I missed that, unfortunately.
I do remember that night. I think I gave 4 naps for the upcoming Cheltenham Festival, none of which won, so I haven't been back since.
All right. It's been brilliant to talk to you, Joe.
And you guys. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Joe Foley there joining us here on Friday Night Racing. As always, Friday Night Racing brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Johnny, just want to touch on a couple of other stories this week. Obviously, the really sad story of the Grand National winning jockey Liam Treadwell dying at the age of just 34. Rode Mon Mom to win the Grand National, one of the most memorable national winners of recent times, 100-1. And just reading about this, just a real terrible tragedy.
Yeah, desperately sad, Nathan. And, you know, I think these things, you know, when you hear them, you don't really need to have met the person to have a deep sense of sort of sickness in your own stomach when you hear something like this. And I'm 37. He was 34, so 3 years younger than me. And he had spoken in the past about, you know, why he retired. Just maybe physically it was getting a bit too much for him in terms of injuries. But he did speak about the mental pressures that ensued from that. And, you know, we've had, you know, a few tragic cases in British racing in the past couple of years that have, I suppose, brought home, you know, the need to talk if you have an issue. And racing can be a very, very tough game when you give up as a jockey. You have to, you know, you have to go into a new life. Your routine is gone. And those who, you know, don't ride anymore, there's no certain path to kind of making money or whatever it is. And the thing about him was that I never met him, and I can't say I'd you know, heard an awful lot about him. But when you see all of these plaudits that came out subsequent to his death, it was clear that he was just a really, really nice person. And Venetia Williams was really moved, and anyone I spoke to Fran Berry yesterday, he was an absolute gentleman. And unfortunately, when this happens, it invariably seems to be the best of the best that end up leaving us. And it just leaves you feeling a bit empty. But as Sean Flanagan was tweeting on, putting on Twitter subsequently, just make that step to talk to people if you are feeling in trouble, because you know, you can definitely make the right progress. And you know, depression is very, very high in terms of percentage. There was a study done in Ireland a year or two ago, and there's very, very high rates of depression in among Irish jockeys, and it's something that we can never treat lightly. And I hope it's something that we are making a lot of progress on.
Yeah, it is very, very sad, that news of Liam Treadwell. Finally, Emmett Mullins. This story broke earlier in the week. He's been banned for 3 months for breaching COVID-19 regulations. So the situation was, he arrived at Leopardstown, and part of the protocols that the HRI have implemented to make sure that horse racing can come back safely, and that it's very much seen to be coming back safely, is you go through a range of different measures. And when you arrive at the course, you basically have a barcode that shows that you've done all the necessary procedures, and you show that, and then you're allowed into the track. He didn't have that. And then, I think, as Mullen said, in a bit of a panic because of one of his runners that he wanted to go and check on, snuck into the course and was obviously spotted. And because of that, and arguably because he was the first, they've come down very, very harsh on him.
Yeah, I was texting him afterwards. I said he shouldn't have done it, or at the very least, he should have done a De Valera escaping from prison and dressed as a woman or something, because it was fairly unlikely that he was going to get away with it. Not that many people at the races. I haven't been racing pretty much. I can't go racing, but I can say from when I went before the lockdown, you know, those 10 days there was of racing before the lockdown, it's not that hard to spot everyone who's there, because there's no one there. You know, I personally, I think the measure is completely disproportionate to the offence. But at the same time, clearly the authorities are trying to make an example here. Racing was really relieved to get back going at all. The fact that trainers over 70 and owners haven't been able to go racing remains a sore point. But, you know, the main thing was that racing got back going. And in fairness to Emmett, I have to say I admire him on this. He didn't make a song and dance about it. And he offered his $5,000 of a fine to frontline workers, which I thought was a really good move. And he basically said, yeah, I'm sorry. And now, if you're not running a horse on its merits, or you're you know, getting into skullduggery, I think this is you'd probably get the death sentence if you were to go by this 3 month ban. But at the same time, you made a mistake. I think Johnny Murta turned up to the track recently, didn't have his documentation, and he went home. And in fairness to the IHRB, they can't they can't play around with this. You know, we sort of were reliant on the goodwill of the government in a way to get racing going again. We're living in truly extraordinary times. I do wonder if Kevin Prendergast, who's been given out a lot about not being able to go racing, who I think is 88, he's turned 88 recently, if Kevin tried to hop the gate and get in, would they have done the same thing? Maybe not, but Emmett's young enough to take it on the chin.
Yeah, and just one more story on Emmett Mullins, and we might try and cover this next week in Friday Night Racing. So he's going to miss out on the Derby next week at the Curragh. But Rachel Blackmore has been booked to ride in the Irish Derby, which I presume, has that come out of nowhere?
It has. I mean, Rachel has very little experience riding on the flat. The Derby is a strange race tomorrow because it's the biggest field since, I think, the 70s or something like that. It's not a good Derby on paper, it has to be said. You know, there are a lot of horses that really shouldn't be in a Derby, but it's that type of year. And, you know, the fact that Emmett Mullins has a runner, I think he's about 66-1. Rachel takes the ride. You know, it just adds to the allure of the race. The O'Brien family, the O'Brien family Inc., as they kind of are about to be known now, because they have so many runners between Dunica, Aidan and Joseph. I think they might have 10 of the runners altogether.
Right.
But Emmett's horse, you know, as much as you'd say normally a horse, King of the Throne, shouldn't be in this race. He's rated 92. It wouldn't be amazing if he ran well. And I did hear a suspicion. I'm not sure if Emmett got a stay of execution that might allow him to go to the Derby tomorrow. Those who turn up can see if he did or not. But it's a fascinating Derby. I will say one thing. Jim Bulger said that his horse, Fiscal Rules, is better than his Irish Derby winner, Trading Leather. Now, if Jim is right, this horse should win, because basically this race is not as good to me as the race that Trading Leather won.
So it is Dubai Duty Free Irish Derby weekend at the Curragh, and to mark the occasion, Tote will have a €50,000 trifecta guarantee on race 5 at 6:15 on Saturday. To play the Tote trifecta, you pick their horses to finish first, second and third in the correct order. See thetote.com for more. Speak in Colours finished outside the places at Royal Ascot last Saturday to deny Johnny's each way bet for the Tote Irish Injured Jockeys Charity Fund. The fund remains. Johnny, have you had a winner since I started this?
2 weeks ago. That goes back further than that. I think you've done a very good job, Nathan, to be fair, but I'm going to go for a shorter price one that will probably get beat as well this week. But Sir Dragonet tomorrow on the alleged stakes.
Come on, Johnny, we want the full trifecta.
Well, there are only 5 horses in the race, so, you know, it's possible. They all have a chance. This horse is interesting, Nathan. I think it's, if you are a floating racing voter, these are the kind of interesting ones. So he should win the race on all known form, but people are already jumping to a conclusion that he's having to think about it. He was favoured for the Derby last year. He's run 5 times since. He hasn't won any of them. He should have won at Ascot, but he didn't. You could make excuses for him, and people are probably starting to question him at this stage. But I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, and if that is the case, that he's genuine, and he basically produces his running, he should win the alleged stakes tomorrow, which is at 4:45.
Give me the name again.
Sir Dragonet. I think he's... Actually, I can't remember. He may be some historical fiction character, but anyway, he's something to do with his sire Camelot. Might go back to something to do with Camelot and the tales of King Camelot. But anyway, there he is.
All right, sure, he made it up as he went along. That's the main thing. Friday Night Racing and Off the Ball, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie. Have you enjoyed our Liverpool love-in today on Off the Ball, Johnny?
I haven't been listening, to be honest.
No.
I had a couple of other things to do, but it was amazing actually watching it last night to see Kenny Dalglish and all these, obviously Tomo and all these characters. It was hard not to get emotional. You know, my father and brother have been watching Liverpool for the last, essentially since the early 90s. I was brought along for the ride. I became a bit more of a League of Ireland fan, but what that would mean to my brother and my father at the moment, you know, it wasn't lost on me last night because it's a long, long time to wait. I think as a Mayo Gaelic Games fan, you can kind of relate to it. It's just, you just want to get that win out of the way. It was like me and Galway hurling. Once, at least you win something, and kind of felt like that for Liverpool fans. But watching Klopp last night, it was just very hard not to be moved by just the class of the man, and he did everything right and even managed to kind of keep a straight face while Kenny Dalglish spoke on a line that was particularly dodgy on Sky Sports News. But it was amazing. And I suppose, Nathan, the one thing about that Liverpool team, you just get the feeling that they are a really good bunch of people. You know, they know they're very privileged, but everything about them is epitomised by Jordan Henderson and Milner. Just decent lads who know they're lucky, but also know their place in the world.
Mm. I'll tell you, it's going to be some Christmas if Mayo win the All-Ireland the Saturday before.
I'll be there, probably with Joe Foley and Tony Mullen.
Yeah. Eating top quality steak. Johnny, great stuff.
Thanks, Nathan.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
And they're off.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.